This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
Sit here, dear. Morning.
Morning.
Well, what you got?
Well, there's egg and bacon. Egg, sausage and bacon. Egg and Spam. Egg, bacon and Spam. Egg, bacon, sausage and Spam. Spam, bacon, sausage and Spam. Spam, egg, Spam, Spam, bacon and Spam. Spam, sausage, Spam, Spam, Spam. Bacon, Spam, tomato and Spam. Spam, 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 egg and Spam. Spam, 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 Spam.
Well, when the Monty Python crew performed their famous Spam routine, little did they realize that the name of that processed meat in a can would gain notoriety, not for the many ways to serve it, but as a moniker for junk email. And if you're like me, you get so much spam clogging your email inbox that it's getting hard to pick out the messages you do want to read. Even junk mail filters can't seem to keep up with the clever tricks that spam artists have come up with to outsmart them. In fact, spam has become such a problem that it might kill the use of email as a primary means of communication. According to a recent study, 45% of all email being sent today is spam. That's up from 16% just a year ago. If you look at my mailbox, I'm sure it's a lot more than 45%. Well, what can we do to fight back? A number of legal remedies are sitting on Capitol Hill awaiting action. Many states have their own versions of anti-spam laws. Some lawsuits have been filed and won against spammers, but the volume of junk email is growing. And how can any law passed by Congress or a state touch spammers, many of them who live in Europe, China, or offshore someplace where American laws can't touch them? This hour, we'll talk with the experts about getting rid of spam, including one who claims to have a 100% success rate in blocking unwanted messages. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest. Ted Gavin is an officer and a member of the board of directors of the Spam Con Foundation in San Francisco. And he joins us today from a phone from Philadelphia. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Ira.
You're welcome. Phil Goldman is the founder and chief executive officer of Mailblocks Incorporated in Los Altos, California. He joins us today from his office there. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Ira.
Ted, let me get some of the basics that everybody wonders. How does my name, how does your name, how does anybody's name get on a spam mailing list?
Well, once you use your email address in any type of forum where you don't have direct control, it's pretty much open for grabs. Submitting your email address to websites can open you to that type of exposure, depending entirely on the privacy policy in use at that website. What a lot of people don't realize is they'll provide personal information, entering a contest, for example, or signing up for a subscription list, not realizing that some websites say very plainly that they're going to sell that information to their business partners. And that's one way. The most onerous of all the ways, I think, is called scraping, which is using your email address in any publicly accessible forum. And then spammers will use automated software programs that simply skip from website to website following links. And anything that looks like an email address, they grab and ultimately test. And anything that looks like a valid email address, they add to a list, which then gets used or sold to other people who then use it and sell it on. So if your email address is accessible in any type of public forum, you're probably going to get spam and rather quickly, as we're finding out.
Can't they also generate, you know, email addresses? If there are millions of tens of millions of people who have AOL.com at the end of their email.
Oh, sure.
Can't they just make up names and they're going to hit people?
Absolutely. That's one of the more insidious practices is called a dictionary attack, where a spammer will simply pick a domain name, like at AOL.com, and then try every successive combination of letters and numbers at that domain name. One of the reasons why this is such a destructive practice is that, first, it hits everybody in that domain indiscriminately, and second, it ties up the bandwidth and the processes of the ISP, which just raises the economic damage to that ISP and to its customers incrementally.
Are there any typical filters out there that are tried?
There are a number of different filters, and filters exist at a number of different levels. For the ISP, you know, for an enterprise-wide filter, there are numerous commercial filters. There are numerous publicly available block lists that each have different types of content And I think at last count, there were somewhere in the order of in excess of 400 publicly available block lists, all with different criteria, all that block different types of systems, such as networks that are inhabited by known spammers, open relays, which are mail servers that are so insecure that they can be used by spammers to bounce messages and disguise their actual origin. Mm-hmm. And ISPs will determine what has the best mix for them.
Now, Phil Goldman, you run Mailblox, which is an email service similar to Hotmail or Yahoo, but with several key additional features. Tell us, and you're claiming that you have 100% blockage from spam. What are you doing? Tell us about that.
Well, we're trying to turn the problem around. The traditional problem with these anti-spam techniques is they use filters or other techniques where computers have to guess what is spam and what isn't spam. And until computers are literally as smart as human beings, that's going to be a very hard thing to do. In fact, even people argue about what is and is not spam. And we turn the problem around, and we note that the spammers, in order to send out millions of pieces of email, which they must do, need to use computers too. And instead of them fooling our computers, we'll trick their computers into not being able to send spam to our customers.
And how does that work? If they send me spam, how do you block it?
Well, what we do is, in between them sending the spam and you, if you were using Mailblox receiving it, we put a puzzle in between. And the puzzle is something that a human being can solve very, very easily. You know, like look at these numbers and type them in, if they're in a picture. But a computer, state-of-the-art computer, can't do right now. So the people get through, but the computers don't.
So so the puzzle goes back to the original sender, and if it's a person, he or she can fill it out and resend it.
That's exactly right, and they can do it very quickly. But
right.
Because computers can't recognize characters, especially if they're a little bit blurred, they can't do it.
Can I also tell you what people I want to get through?
Yes, you can do that because, you know, there may be some people ahead of time who are in your address book, for example, and of course they should be able to get through right away.
And you say that Mailblox has eliminated 100% of the spam from your users in Mailblox?
Well, I'm crossing my fingers as I say this, but so far we've been operating this since last summer, and
right.
Not a single piece of spam has come through.
Now, it has worked so well that you feel that there are competitors of yours who have stolen your idea, and you're actually suing them. Is that correct?
Well, that is true. We own the patents in this area, and we, you know, it's very important. We developed them over many, many years and own them, and we think that this is the right now the solution for spam.
Mm-hmm. What's your reaction, Ted, to this?
Well, challenge response systems are in wide use. They have limited application, however. First, they don't actually stop the spam from being sent. They do prevent the user from seeing it in their inbox. They tend to mitigate the false positive problem, as was alluded to earlier, by simply putting the message aside. And if there's a human being who's sending it, great. They can answer the challenge with a response, and then the email will be delivered to the user. The place where challenge response systems start to be detrimental is when you move it past a one-to-one relationship. For example, if I place an online order for airline tickets, I don't necessarily know the email address of the automatic sender that's going to send me the copy of my airline ticket. That's going to hit my mailbox. It's going to generate a response, and I may never see that email. Now, there are ways that challenge response systems put off those types of emails to the side, so I can eventually go into, you know, a pending folder, for example, of all unanswered responses or unanswered challenges, and I can pick out my airline ticket if I'm waiting for it and for some reason haven't received it. But as we move past the one-to-one relationship, one person sending email to another person, the challenge response mechanism begins to show some problems.
Mm-hmm.
Not typically usable in a customer relationship management type of format. If I send email to info at a business, I'm not going to be terribly happy if I've expressed interest about becoming their customer and they come back and challenge me. So there are some limiting factors in that. But for one-to-one, there are some implications that make it positive. There are interesting questions, such as what happens if one person using a challenge response system sends an email to someone else using another challenge response system. Only the most poorly configured systems will start a ping pong going back and forth, but you can end up in a situation where each person's challenge is held up waiting for the other mail server's challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So it does have uses. It is certainly one small part of the vast technological solution, which makes up the answer to spam. But I think to say that it blocks 100% of all spam without saying to the only to the mailboxes of the people who use that service would give somebody the wrong impression.
Let me get allow Phil to respond to that.
I agree with everything that Ted said, and in particular, the place where these challenge response systems literally fall down is when you have a computer solicited computer email that you want to receive. And so for example, in our service, we have an additional system that allows you to have special email addresses that will go straight through to you. If you go to a website and give out an email address, you just give a special one that will go straight through. And I also agree with Ted that I think it can work broadly, but it is most appropriate for consumers, and that's who we're reaching out to right now. There are social issues with businesses, especially vendors, who want to use it. But for consumers, I'll qualify it a little bit more. For consumers who do use this service, they never see spam again.
Ted, you said there were other technological fixes. Can you name any?
Well, there are a number of different types of filters that exist at the user level, some better than others, of course. I think
they're not working that well if we're still getting all that spam coming through.
Well, one of the inherent problems in filtering is that it's a reactive measure. You see a spam, you increase your filter to catch that instance of spam in the future, and then the spammers find a new way to get past it. As network administrators and users build higher and broader walls to keep out the spam, the spammers come up with more ingenious battering rams to get through them.
What about these spam laws? There are four of them on Capitol Hill. There are many in states. Do they look promising? Or, as I mentioned before, a lot of these companies are offshore. They're in different countries. The laws may not even touch them.
There's a growing problem with the myriad of states' laws that exist. Some of them are very, very strong laws that haven't been terribly useful. For example, Delaware was the first and only state to ban unsolicited bulk commercial email outright. I doubt any residents of Delaware are seeing a decrease in spam, however. Missouri might as well not have a spam law. It just says you have to have an opt-out link. So that poses the federal question. We haven't seen a law come through Congress yet, even proposed, that would really be effective. Some are actually worse than others, and some could make the problem worse before it gets better. The inherent problem with the existing laws is that most of them have predicated opt-out as an option, which basically means if I'm sending email, I can send email to everybody at least once. That's a whole lot of email. A responsible law would predicate opt-in.
Who pays for all this spam?
Well, the problem with spam is that the cost of sending this email is shifted from the sender to the recipient and to the recipient's network and to any of the intermediate networks that carry the email. It costs me not a penny more to send 1 million emails than it does to send 1,000. So the cost is transferred to the ISPs that have to pay for the traffic, that have to pay for the connection and store this email, and that gets passed right down to the ISP subscriber or user, usually to the tune of $2 to $3 a month.
So we get the spam and we're paying for it.
Absolutely.
Wow. The ISPs are probably, obviously, they want to do as much as they can so they don't have to shoulder this burden.
Oh, certainly. American Online at the FTC forum last week announced that they were now blocking 2 billion spams a day.
2 billion a day?
2 billion per day.
Wow. All right. We're gonna take a short break and come back and talk lots more about spam and take your calls. Talking with Ted Gavin, office and member of the board of directors of SpamCon Foundation in San Francisco. Phil Goldman is a founder and chief executive officer at Mailblox Incorporated in Los Altos, California. And we'll hear some of your spam woes when we come back, so stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about stopping spam with my guest, Ted Gavin, officer and member of the board of directors of SpamCon Foundation in San Francisco, Phil Goldman, founder and chief executive officer of Mailblox Incorporated in Los Altos, California. And there are a lot of people that would like to talk about spam, so let's go right to the phones. Let's go to San Francisco to Craig. Hi, Craig.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Hi, how are you? Go ahead.
I've been busy. I run a little family of community websites called Craigslist. And, well, with my name on the thing, I feel compelled to fight every case of spam we hear about. And, actually, the California anti-spam law has been very effective in helping me do that. I've shut down or somehow stopped about 150 spammers.
And what does the California law allow you to do, and why is it so helpful?
Well, basically when it comes to U.S.-based spammers, I can talk to them or their hosting services or other ISPs, and I can frequently get them to stop. As soon as I'm done with this call, I'll be calling two of them, two hosting services, and try to persuade them to cancel the accounts of two different spammers.
And why is it in their interest to do this if they're making money from the spammers?
Well, you know, a lot of them, if you ask them to do the right thing, and if you're persistent, then they'll do it.
And if not, you have the curmudgeon, the cludgeon, the whatever of the state of California, too.
Well, in practice, that's not very practical, although part two, I'm now talking to state and federal legislators trying to figure out which is the best of the anti-spam legislation, trying to let them know some of the practical issues involved in working with the ISPs in particular, and the intent is to improve some of the best of the legislation, and I'm considering starting an email campaign, which could be either a flop or really big, to get some of that legislation passed.
And what do you do about the offshore spam people?
Frankly, the offshore spam people, I have no idea about a solution yet. But so far, we've been very lucky. We've stopped a lot. We tend to scare them away. And it's working. It may only be working a third of the time, but if everyone who ran a significant site did that, if they went to the same effort, we'd all be a lot better off.
Ted, you agree with that? That's getting the operators involved here?
Absolutely. Network providers have a great incentive to shut spammers down on their network. There are a lot of negative incentives that are out there, including being caught up in filters, being caught up in block lists, the threat of litigation. You know, California's spam law was one of the earlier ones in September of 1998, and has been used pretty widely and with varying degrees of success. The Washington State Attorney General's office has had a great deal of success in tracking down spammers, both domestic and offshore, by simply following the money, to use an oft-quoted cliche, to the point where they recently announced the success tracking down somebody who was involved in a spam operation by finding the person who paid the credit card bill on the credit card that was used to rent the space at the Internet service provider from which the spam was sent. So there are varying degrees of difficulty in tracking down offshore spammers, but if you happen to have the resources of a state attorney general's office, it can be done. The biggest problem has been commanding the degree of attention and resources that warrants that type of work.
Could be a political issue now as it's growing.
Well, I think the number of bills that we've seen come in from the Congress in the last few weeks clearly underscores the fact that it is now a political issue. People are demanding that their representatives and senators do something.
All right, Craig, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to David in Ogden, Utah. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a low-tech solution. Yeah, low-tech solution for solving this.
Uh-huh.
For every spam someone sends, they have to eat a can of spam. Or feed them a can of spam. It would stop.
All right, David, thanks for calling.
Bet.
Why can't we just reverse the spam and send it back to the, you know, in certain ways? Can't we just reverse it and send it back to all these people who send it to us and just overload them?
Well, you know, you could do that, although network abuse is network abuse in both directions. You know, mail bombing somebody because they sent you spam is just as illegal as doing it for any other reason. Plus, you're now doubling the amount of email traffic, so you've not only not fixed the problem, but you've pretty much broken email forever.
And how effective is spam? Do we, a lot of us, make, you know, use of all this junk mail, you know, all kinds of things that you can get on email? And by doing so, are we keeping it alive?
Well, clearly, there's somebody out there who wants to receive some of the email. And a big distinction that does need to be drawn right up front is content doesn't make something spam. The issue is consent. If I wanted to receive it and I asked to receive it, it doesn't matter what the content is, it's not spam because it's solicited. But if it's unsolicited bulk email, and bulk could contain commercial or non-commercial, it could be political or apolitical speech, it's still spam because I didn't want it, and the economic damage is the same regardless. So on the consent, or on the content issue rather, clearly there's somebody out there who wants to be receiving some of this content. The remainder of the content obviously is just out there to try and dupe people out of some money. the FTC finding that somewhere on the order of a third of all of the email they surveyed had some element of fraudulent content. So, you know, clearly there's somebody who's answering this stuff. The problem is that it doesn't have to be very many people. Because the cost to spam is so low and the barrier to entry is so low, you don't need a huge response to generate a positive return on investment.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there a company out there that actually tags your emails with a service mark identifying you as a legitimate server?
There's a company called Habeas that provides a service wherein you can, if you have their service mark, which is a haiku, the assertion is that it is not spam and that it agrees to go by their boundaries and their rules. There's a much larger program that was introduced last week called the Trusted Email Open Standard, which we at SpamCon think actually poses a great opportunity for consumers to have a lot more trust in the email that they receive, under which there are numerous levels and levels of assertion that the sender would make as to their identity, the type of email you're receiving, the nature of the email, and why they're sending it to you, all of which is designed to be secure so the consumer can have and the network operators can have some initial level of trust in what's coming across their path and be able to make decisions based on those assertions. And that's a structure under which any number of different commercial programs or non-commercial programs could operate.
Is this going to continue to be a spy versus spy, offense versus defense sort of technology?
It certainly will be. Any solution that's been out there thus far has seen spammers try and dupe it by hiding themselves even further, which does beg the question, what are you thinking if you're selling something but you don't ever want to be recognized as the person who's selling it? As technological solutions come down the pike, we'll see spammers try and get around them. I think we're starting to see some really secure solutions that will be more difficult to spoof or to hide around.
You agree, Phil?
Well, I agree, except I think that there are solutions like ours that are out there already, and so as a generalization, that's true. But you know, spam is is an epidemic. It's very much like a medical epidemic. It's worldwide. It's very, very difficult to stop, and it's getting worse and worse. And you can look at legislation, you can look at standards, both of which Ted has talked about, but what do you do if there's a terrible outbreak? What you do is you try and solve the problem immediately and then generalize and regulate, et cetera. We think that companies like Mailblox have an immediate solution for people. And you don't have to wait to see these other things come down the road. You can have the problem solved right now and then see it generalized later on.
And Phil's absolutely right. You know, we feel that the solution to spam is multifaceted. There has to be a legal facet, there has to be a technological facet, and there needs to be an educational and social facet as well. And they all need to work together.
Let's see if I can get to a call from Augusta, Georgia. Shula, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I have a problem with someone that insists on sending us, my husband and myself, pornographic emails. The messages come without an address. It has a pseudo address, which changes all the time. We have applied all the blocks. I have applied parental controls to the point that my computer doesn't run even. And I get them twice a day. I have contacted everybody I could think of to stop this garbage. Anyone from the local sheriff department to the federal government. I have gone to all the places that I was told to go. And
mm-hmm. We all get that stuff, Shula. I'm not putting it down. It's a great question.
But I have a proposition for that.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yes. Why can email that has no viable address be stopped? Just do not let it run. You don't show your email. You just don't send it.
You mean block email that has no return address?
That's right. Does not have an email address.
Mm-hmm.
I think Shula has an excellent point, and that's exactly the type of technological solution that I was just mentioning. Was If the sender is willing to assert exactly who they are, then you'll accept their commercial email. Otherwise, they don't get through.
And it shouldn't be my doing. It should be MSN, Yahoo, AOL, all the networks.
Absolutely. I mean, the burden of responsible marketing is on the part of the marketer.
And I would add that for a system like Challenge Response, the very first thing that happens is an email goes back to the sender. So if they sent this offensive email without a real email address,
you cannot do that.
It would never come through.
That's right. And it's the most disgusting and obscene material. I have been sending it daily to the local sheriff department. I have been sending it to MSN, to Yahoo, AOL, whoever.
Shula,
yes.
Do you use your email mostly for social or is it business email?
Well, we are searching for different things on the Internet, and we have been exposed to sites that we are not sure what happens afterwards.
If Shula, if you want some information on some of the other remedies that you have, you can always go to the SpamCon Foundation's website at www.spamcon.org.
Okay.
And you know, you might try Phil's mailbox. I have
applied so many that my computer sometimes doesn't run anymore.
Yes, this machine that was supposed to be so productive now just spits out pornography at you.
I just hate that stuff. When I turn on my computer, I see red.
I have young kids. You know, that's when it gets me upset also.
Well,
you know?
I don't have young kids.
And they don't have any choice in this matter.
I know, and that is awful. There is even a site where it's supposed to help you protect young children. Well, have you ever tried to report to them? It's impossible.
Well, everybody is swamped by this. Ted, how many AOL did you say spams are a day?
They're blocking 2 billion a day. And that means that the ones that are getting through are in excess of the 2 billion.
It's unbelievable.
And one of the things I think that makes the problem even more annoying is, as Shula pointed out, that you know many of these anti-spam systems expect you to do a lot of work. Like you should set up filters, or you should say what level you want. I mean, what level of spam protection do you want? How do you even decide something like that? You just want it gone.
See, I'm doing all of that, and I'm at a level that my computer runs only on one leg.
Right.
You know, it's just,
and,
it doesn't even
all right,
run
Julia,
right
we sympathize with you. Thanks for calling. Before we run out of time, I want to get another question to Ted or both of you. The FTC had this forum last week. Isn't the FTC in charge, sort of legally, of policing all of this?
Well, the FTC has a limited scope. They are responsible for chasing down those who advertise irresponsibly or fraudulently. So a lot of the email that has fraudulent content does come under their bailiwick. But it's a big world, and the FTC can't necessarily chase somebody overseas. I will say that the event last week was a turning point, I think, in the debate on spam. The FTC clearly understands the complexities of this issue, and they are way out in front of it now.
Mm-hmm. And so you were at that meeting. What was the mood? Was we're finally attacking it now? Or
I think the work product of that is phenomenal. There was huge consensus drawn on a lot of the spam issues, and while, as Phil mentioned, some people have differing opinions as to what is spam and what isn't. There was a lot of discussion about some of the more difficult issues to pin down, such as the use of block lists, the use of litigation involving the spam issue. And I think we're at a position now where we can really move forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Internet is certainly a wild place. It was a Wild West place from the beginning. It's even wilder now. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for both joining us now to talk about the spam problem. Ted Gavin, officer and member of the board of directors of the SpamCon Foundation in San Francisco. Phil Goldman, founder and chief executive officer of Mailblox Incorporated in Los Altos, California. Thank you both for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.